Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
Today we're going to discuss a topic that I've been wanting to discuss for a very long time. In fact, the reason for the holdup, the reason why I didn't do this earlier, was because I had done some research and come across something, and then I couldn't find it again. And it took me a hell of a long time to find it and to confirm it. So that is the thing that's really held it up, maybe for almost a year or something along those lines. Because this is a topic I wanted to discuss, but I wanted to discuss it with all the data at hand. In the meantime, I did find some additional things, which will also be in this video. So you may think that the real issue here is about religion. And while we are discussing religion endlessly in this topic, if you bear with me, you will see that the real topic that we're discussing is not religion. It may seem like religion at first, and the title of the video, which is "Only Jews Have a Direct Telephone Line to God and They Speak to Him," may make you think that, yeah, what about Christians talking to God? We will discuss that, and you'll see that when we get to the end of this video, that actually the real issue is something completely different. And it's something that I've noticed, but I'd never seen anyone else who noticed it. And then I came across Ben Klassen. And there in one of Ben Klassen's books, there he pointed out exactly the same thing that I'd been thinking about. So this may sound like a simple topic or just a religious topic at first, but by the time you get to the end of this video, you will see things from so many angles, and then the religious stuff will then be removed and you will start to see something that you've maybe never thought of before. In fact, I'm absolutely convinced you've never thought of this before. And the bunch of stories behind this is quite weird. On the screen in front of you, a couple of things to look at. On the top left is an article by a Jewish rabbi, and it's on the topic of spirituality, how to talk to God. And then it says the Hasidic practice of one of those weird Jew terms. Talking to God freely in one's native tongue helps to build intimacy over time. So here's a Jew who is telling other Jews about talking to God. But you will discover later on that there's a whole lot more to this than just this kind of thing. Though what he's talking about in this article might be similar to what Christians may think. You know, that you pray and you communicate with God in that way. But you'll see how this topic changes, because there's a whole lot more to this topic than meets the eye. On the top right is a very lovely drawing that someone put together probably quite a number of years ago, where they put together four great white thinkers of recent centuries, starting with Darwin, then Nietzsche, then Hitler, then Klassen. Christians might not like the whole Darwin thing, but we're not here to discuss Darwin. What we are really here to discuss are the observations of Ben Klassen and a whole bunch of other stuff. But the bottom line is that this National Socialist who put this together saw at least Nietzsche, Hitler, and Klassen as great thinkers. And I will tell you that I definitely agree with that notion. I do see Ben Klassen among those guys. I have got a serious respect for Ben Klassen. Ben Clarkson is extremely clever. I definitely think that after Hitler and after World War II, that Ben Clarkson is in a very special category. He's a really, really deep thinker. And the fact that he ended up focusing on creating a whole church for whites puts him in very much a similar space where Nietzsche was. Nietzsche wasn't thinking of a church for whites, but when you understand some of Nietzsche's writings, you'll see that Nietzsche approached it literally from a biblical point of view. His book, Thus Spake Zarathustra, is exactly in that category. He's taken a topic and he's written it in a style that is like a biblical style. And his topic is very deep. We will get to Nietzsche. There are things I need to tell you about Nietzsche. We might have to do a shortish intro to Nietzsche because Nietzsche is very, very important. The man is incredibly deep. But Ben Clarkson is really impressive, and that's why I put out the autobiography of Ben Clarkson, because Ben is in a whole other level compared to anyone who's come after World War II. He really is up there with Hitler and Nietzsche. He really is. And I found a very lovely photo of Ben Clarkson there on the bottom left. That is a young Ben Clarkson with his wife. And I like that photo a lot. And when you go through his autobiography, I must tell you, I've got a serious respect for his wife. His wife is an amazing woman. She's an incredibly loyal woman. That woman stood with Ben through thick and thin, right through his whole life. Whatever happened to Ben, his wife was always there, always willing to work and do her thing. That woman is really an incredible woman. And it's lovely to see these photos of them when they were young. Everyone's looking attractive. Everyone's looking neat. Everyone is looking quite classy. And Ben Clarkson is an impressive person. I really think that sadly, we've lost some of the history of Ben Clarkson. That man really fascinates me. And on the bottom right photo is simply a logo that I found where somebody said, National Socialism and the Religion of Nature. And that really is the key to Nietzsche, Hitler, Clarkson, is the whole issue is about viewing life from a natural nature point of view. That is so important. You know, when they go and they shriek and they whine about Hitler, Hitler was just a guy who was telling you the straight truth as per science and history. That's all. That's it. There is nothing more to Hitler than that. So when you hear all this screaming and crying about Hitler, what has really taken place is that Hitler is a guy who used science and history and a good understanding of humans, and all he did was he was telling you how life is, how it's always been, and how it's always going to be. And that's it. That's it. He is just telling you the truth, man. He is not even really a proper politician in that sense, if you want to say it that way. He is basing everything he's doing on the facts, and these facts will remain the same 10,000 years from now. So let's start off with the issue of talking to God. I decided to ask some of the people that I know personally who are very religious, I decided to ask them about talking to God. And if I say to them, do you speak to God or do people speak to God? And if so, how does it work? That's all. Because I had my understanding of how I thought it worked for white Christians. And then I thought, you know what? Let me just double check to make sure that my understanding is correct. And basically, what they told me confirmed what I suspected all along. But it's worth reading their replies to me, because this is going to set the scene for what's going to come. You will understand more as we progress through this. I'm not going to name names, but these are people that I know in South Africa. All of them are Boers, and I asked them about speaking to God. So this lady that I know, she said the following. She said, God gives signs or sends people to you. He might send signs to you. No, he does not talk directly to us. Because that is the thing that I want to make clear here, is when we talk about speaking to God, the other side of the coin is how does God talk back to us? And when I asked that question, I asked them specifically whether God ever speaks in a voice. So that's already the first issue that I want to make clear to you. Does God speak back to you in an audible voice that you can hear? The voice issue is one of the issues in this video, but there's more. So that is how that lady answered it. Then there was another one from a guy I know very, very well, and he's actually a very accomplished guy, and he said the following. He said, I have never heard God speak in a voice like he spoke to Moses. I just do become aware of the Holy Spirit, almost like your own conscience. Hope that helps. And that guy is a very, very religious guy. Then a German friend of mine who's a Christian, he wrote quite a bunch of things. Let me read what he writes. He says, personally, I have prayed and do so daily, believing that my prayers are heard. Otherwise, it would be a waste of time. I do believe that God can speak to individual people and may do so or has done so, but on rare occasions. Most people who claim the Lord has told me refer to inner unctions, which are usually thoughts that come to mind. Especially young Christians or converts are prone to this. They mean it and they may believe it, but if seriously interviewed, they admit it happened in their thoughts. Nevertheless, if the Lord speaks, it has to be a male voice. I have not met a Christian to whom the Lord has spoken orally. So my German friend is saying that there are people who say the Lord spoke to me or the Lord told me, but when you question them, they did not hear it in their ears, okay? They had thoughts that came to them, and they were sure that those thoughts were from God. But he makes it clear that as Christian as he is, and all the Christians he knows, he's never once met a Christian that heard the voice of God in the same way that you're hearing my voice. Then another Christian friend of mine said the following, no, most Christians do not hear a voice. Generally, God speaks to them through scripture, the Holy Spirit, or signs. Some Christians, when they want guidance from God, will read the Bible till they find some message there. Christians also believe that the Holy Spirit guides them. This is normally through feelings and their conscience. Then there are also signs or symbols that people see. There are some charismatic churches whose members speak in tongues and stuff like that. And I think some of them might say they hear the actual voice of God. But those churches tend to be a minority. So there are a tiny subset of churches, Christian churches, The people might say that they hear the voice of God, but they are the minority. The vast majority of Christians believe that if God communicates with them, that he does so through signs, symbols, conscience, thoughts, etc. And the reason I want to just make this clear to you is because this is how they understand interactions with God. But you're going to see some other stuff coming up. So that's the first issue, the first critical issue. If you speak to God, can you hear God speaking to you? Do you hear him audibly through your ears? And the vast majority of answers, even from the most dedicated Christians, is no. Now let's take a look at some videos where Jews speak, because I want you to hear what they say, but also observe the tone in which they speak and how they speak. They don't just say something. They say it from a particular angle. And these Jews are talking to whites. So just listen to what they say, but also listen to how they say it, the angle from which they come. Here's the first video. This is a Jewish rabbi, and the Jewish rabbi says something for the goyim to hear.
We have to talk about how we're God's chosen people.
We have to look the world straight in the eye. We have to stand strong and proud and tell them that we are the chosen people. The children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are the main characters in the greatest story ever told.
So have a little respect, why don't you? And have a little humility, why don't you? And if you do, we'll be happy to teach you.
Okay, so there was the rabbi telling us that Jews are the main characters in the Bible and that they are the main characters in the greatest story ever told. And then he turns around and says that we should have respect. And then he says we must have a little humility. But the key thing at the beginning of this is we, the Jews, are the chosen people. And then he says that the rest of us should have a little bit of respect for them and a little bit of humility. And if we do, in other words, if we behave ourselves, then they, the Jews, will be happy to teach us, to teach us. Now, in this little chat of his there, there are two key issues. The first one is we are the chosen people. The problem that I have with the concept of we are the chosen people is that Jews come and Jews tell us that God, the ultimate God, the God of the universe or universes or however big everything is, that God chose them. I must tell you that when I look at this story and I hear the Jews saying, we are the chosen people, we are the chosen, not you, we are special, we are the chosen people. I find that to be a hard sell, because if God chose them, wouldn't there have been some other way that God would have indicated to us that he chose them? Why is it that we've got to hear it out of their mouths? How do we know that what they are saying is true if you buy into the storyline? So that is just something that is worth thinking about, is that Jews are insistent that they, only they, are the chosen people, but not everyone else. But notice how he turns this and then says, if you have a little respect, a little humility, we will be happy to teach you. So he's talking down to the non-Jews. The Jew rabbi in this case is talking down to the non-Jews, saying, I We know better than you. You can learn from us. Of course, something I'm not mentioning about the scriptures is that in the Bible, the Jews are also errant people who don't listen to God many times. But here in the real world, we have got these Jews telling us, we know better than you, and we will teach you if you behave yourselves. That is really what that rabbi is saying. So the rabbi is speaking down to everyone else. He's speaking down to the non-Jews of the world, and that is very important. We are the special people. We are the chosen people, and you can learn from us. So that is a very important thing to think about. When I spent my short little period of time in the military in South Africa, the guys used to have a term, because in the military, rank is everything. So rank is a fixed thing, and you have authority according to your rank. So if you're a sergeant, you can order everybody below you around. If you're a sergeant, you can order the corporals and everybody of lower rank around. And if you're, let's say, a captain, then you can order the lieutenants around, and you can order all the other non-commissioned officers around, etc. So in the military, rank is everything. Now, the way that this Jew is speaking, this Jew rabbi is speaking, he's doing what the guys used to call pulling rank. And the term meant that you are using your rank to get your way. So it's not a discussion about, am I right, am I wrong, blah, blah, blah. It's an issue of, I'm the sergeant, you're the corporal, you do what I tell you. Or I'm the general, you know, you are the major, and you do what I tell you. You have to go and do that now. And that is really what this rabbi is doing here. This rabbi is basically pulling rank, and he's saying, we are the chosen people, and we are closer to God. That's basically what it comes to. He's saying, we are the chosen people, which he therefore uses to say, you know, we are superior to you in the eyes of God. So God has chosen us, and we have the authority to order you around. That's basically what this Jew is saying. That's basically what it boils down to. We are the chosen people. So, we are the chosen people becomes, I am a rank higher than you, and therefore, you have to listen to me. So, that is really what this rabbi's game is. Now, we're going to take a look at another rabbi, and we're actually only going to take a look at a part of some stuff where this rabbi was talking, because we're only interested in a specific thing. But in here, you'll see the same thing. This rabbi talks about another rabbi who was in Switzerland, and how he convinced the whites of Switzerland to accept him as a citizen. So just listen to this little video, and I have also left another little story that this rabbi tells in this video. It's very short. It's 2 minutes long.
And behind the car, I tell you, Rav Berkovich from Lausanne in Switzerland, he went to Lausanne. He's not a Swiss citizen. Now they have a committee if to approve him Swiss citizenship. It's almost impossible to get. They don't just give anyone a citizenship. The goyim in Switzerland told him, Rabbi Berkovitz, can you give us one convincing reason why we should approve your citizenship? He said to them, all of you are faithful Christian who believes in God and his son JC, right? the rabbi admit their JC is his son? They all went, yeah, of course, rabbi. We say, and when the Messiah come, right? Let's say JC shows up right here in Luzan. What language exactly is going to talk? He's an Hebrew. He was in yeshiva. He's going to speak the Talmud, the Babylonian language. He was in yeshiva. Who are going to interpret to you what JC wants from you? Oh, you never thought about it. I am the one you need. Approved! It was amazing. I used to give lectures from his book. Brilliant. And also huge, great sense of humor. One time he came to a Christian in an office in December 24th. And he said to him, tonight is the luckiest night of my life. The Christian told him, why, Rabbi, you're a Jew. He said, exactly. He said, no, Baba, tonight is Christmas. So he said to him, yes, I'm very happy. He said, why? You're a Jew. You're not celebrating Christmas. He said, no, but how can I not be happy when 2 billion Christians bow down to one Jew together unanimously? Makes my life. Then after on the 26th, when they went back to the office, he said, ugh, you ruined my entire Christmas. I couldn't even go to church because of you. Thinking that I'm praying to a Jew, ugh, so disgusting. Who needs, you have to prove to them Christianity is wrong.
So here is a rabbi who's busy talking to people, talking to the Jews, and he tells them two stories, both of which are relevant to our chat today. So the first thing is the story about this very clever rabbi who clearly he admires a lot. And this rabbi is trying to get citizenship in a white country, in a white European country, and they ask him, you know, give us a reason why, you know, we should give you citizenship. So this is the story that the rabbi tells. One doesn't always know how true these stories are, but we take it that this is a real story. He's telling it to the others and he's claiming it's true. So he speaks with a certain amount of, credibility for what it's worth. And the story that he tells is of the rabbi who then is asked, you know, why would we need a rabbi in Switzerland? And he comes up with this story of when the Messiah comes, you know, Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So these Christians are impressed with a Jew acknowledging this. And then he says, well, you know, suppose the Messiah comes here. Then, you know, what language do you think he's going to speak? And, you know, he's a Hebrew. He's going to speak, you know, our lingo. And how are you going to understand Jesus when he comes? And apparently this is the reason why this guy got citizenship. At least that's how the story goes. But here again, you can see we have the same issue of pulling rank. When Jesus comes, Jesus is one of us. Jesus will speak our lingo, and that's why you'll need me. Of course, you know, why can't Jesus come and speak the language of those people or communicate with those people in some other way? You know, let's say through mental telepathy or something. But the Jew is using his Jew logic and he's shoving himself in there and saying, ah, when Jesus comes, when the Messiah comes, you're going to need me. And he gives his storyline. So yet another instance of pulling rank. I am special. I am special and you'll need me because of my links to God. So that even Jesus, even if your Jesus arrives, then you'll still need me. And then he tells the story about Christmas. And when a Christian asks him, why is he going to be happy? Then he says, well, I'm happy because 2 billion Christians are bowing down to one Jew. So there again, you can see rank. You can see the Jew pulling rank. That Jews are higher than Christians. That's the angle that he's giving you here. And then the final part of the story, which I kind of enjoyed, is that the Christian was actually really pissed off. And he said, you know what, you ruined my entire Christmas because I was thinking that I might be praying to a Jew. So I suspect perhaps all round that this Jew rabbi is basically telling a lot of true stories. I think his stories have a bit of a true feel to them. Plus, he's talking to a Jewish audience. So I don't think a Jew would lie to a Jewish audience. But anyway, those two stories are both a case of pulling rank, that Jews are high in the hierarchy of the universe, and not only high in the hierarchy of the universe, but they also have billions of Christians who bow down to a Jew. And that is how they see it, and they say, you know, we are superior, we are higher, and they are using their rank in religious terms as something to use and look down on people and feel superior to these white Christians. Now we're going to take a look at another little video, but this is one that you are more familiar with. In this case, we're heading off to Sweden to see some film footage where we meet up with a Jewess whom many of you or most of you are familiar with, and that is Barbara Lerner Spector. So you know what Barbara Lerner Spector said, but it's worth looking through the video again because I want to actually point out a couple of things here. In this case, Spector is not talking religiously. But even so, I want you to see what she says. And we must look carefully at what she does. And you'll see a similar pattern here. So this video is short. It's just over a minute long. Take a look at this. Watch it closely. Look at it carefully, by the way, because then I'll make a bunch of points.
Such.
As we heard, there are people in Sweden who support Israel and have a deep sense of the injustice of the present situation. It's these people who give hope to those who still believe that things will get better here. One of them is Barbara Spector, a former American who made Aliyah and then, 10 years ago, with the help of the government of Sweden, set up a non-denominational institute of Jewish learning with the Greek name of Paideia here in Stockholm. She believes the current wave of anti-Semitism in Sweden will pass and that Jews have an important role to play in a country undergoing profound change.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Paideia.
I just want to take a certain 10-second snippet out of what Spector is saying. And I'm going to play it to you 3 times. So just listen to that particular snippet, because she says something extremely interesting in that snippet.
They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Okay, after that hectic dose of Barbara Spector, it's time to unpack all of that stuff. Because in that little bit that you see there, there's actually a bunch of stuff. There's actually a lot of stuff in that very short video. So this is about Sweden. And they mentioned that Spector, Barbara Spector, is a former American who went on Aliyah. You'll notice that with the Jews, you constantly hear all kinds of Jew terms, all kinds of weird Jewish terms that you've never heard before, and you don't know how to understand them or what they mean exactly. You know, if someone says, "Oh, I went on Aliyah," you know, you wouldn't know what the hell that is. Unless you've gone and actually studied Jews, you wouldn't know. And as I recall, Spector, Barbara Spector, was a professor in America. What is Aliyah? Well, let me tell you what Aliyah is, and I'm going to read it to you. The term Aliyah in Judaism refers to two primary concepts. One, immigration to Israel. Aliyah literally means ascent or going up, and is used to describe the immigration of Jews from the diaspora to the land of Israel. It is considered a significant and positive action, often associated with fulfilling the biblical commandment of returning to the promised land. The concept of Aliyah is deeply rooted in Jewish history and tradition, symbolizing both a physical and spiritual return to the Jewish homeland. Then the second concept relating to Aliyah is being called to the Torah. Aliyah refers to the honor of being called up to recite a blessing over the Torah during a synagogue service. When the Torah is read, individuals are called up to the Bema, I think that's the pronunciation, the platform from which the Torah is read, to recite blessings before and after the Torah reading. This is considered a special honor and an important part of Jewish worship. Both uses of the term highlight the notion of spiritual elevation and connection to Jewish heritage and tradition. So Aliyah is really a Jewish concept, and it's Judaism. We're looking at Judaism here, and it's about doing more and doing specific things. And in this case, it's seen that when a Jew moves to Israel, that it's going up. It is a positive thing. If you look at all these particular things, like Jews being encouraged to move to Israel, what you are actually seeing is nationalism. Zionism is another example of Jews doing something that whites and others do, but they deliberately give it their own term and use their own term. So for Jews, nationalism is Israel, but they don't call it nationalism, they call it Zionism. And you'll see that there are quite a number of things that Jews do that they could have just expressed in English in another way. They could have said, "We want nationalism for ourselves," but they don't. So it's quite interesting also that Jews have to invent and use other terms in their, quotes, language, and that even when they speak to us, they don't use our language and our terms. even if our terms are quite adequate for the job. They shove their Jew term in our faces. There is a certain arrogance and, again, that top-down issue from this mode of behavior when it comes to words and terms. But there's maybe some deeper stuff here, because consider that Aliyah is a Jew moving to Israel, and this is now, let's say, a religious thing that's good for them in their view. But how come, if she's moved to Israel, she's now living in Sweden? What's this about? She's done Aliyah, and clearly Aliyah is linked to Israel, but she's now in Sweden. Isn't that weird? Or is she in Sweden on Jewish business, on Israeli Jewish business, to do something to Sweden? Eh? You should really sit and ask yourself, if she's doing Aliyah, then what's this other story? Why is she now in Sweden? And, you know, if Israel is the heart and soul of everything, why is she in Sweden? Or is she in Sweden on some kind of mission? You may recall that I did a video called The Art of Mismanagement. I did a video and it was called The Art of Mismanagement, the biggest con job that has fooled all whites everywhere. If you haven't watched it, I urge you to watch it, because The Art of Mismanagement will show you how whites are gradually conditioned and gradually fooled over a period of time. And whites eventually start forgetting certain things. So watch The Art of Mismanagement. We therefore can ask ourselves, is Barbara Spector busy with mismanagement in Sweden? Is she there to mismanage and mislead the whites of Sweden? That's a question we can ask ourselves. The next thing in that little video was that Barbara Spector has set up an organization of Jewish learning, and they've used a Greek term of paideia. And this organization of Jewish learning was even set up with government help. And if you look there in that video, if you'd noticed, you'll see all these white people, white men and women, sitting there quietly in a room, and somebody's talking and the others are listening and so forth. So there is Spector sitting there as the teacher, and she's basically teaching the whites with government aid, by the way. The white government is actually paying for this junk to take place. I should mention, did you notice with Barbara Spector that in that interview that she has a problem with her one eye? Her one eye is almost closing when the other eye is open. I don't know what to make of that, whether it is her under stress or whatever. But let's continue analyzing Barbara Spector, because she now has this organization, Paideia, for Jewish learning. And I must tell you that having a name like that, a Greek name like that, this definitely has a purpose. She is definitely trying to make out like this is some kind of, quotes, university, you know. You know, this is learning, a serious place of learning, okay? But it could be a place of wrong learning. Anyway, Spector herself then says that she believes that the current wave of anti-Semitism will pass, and that Jews have an important role to play in a country that is undergoing profound change. Now, among the questions I have is, why does Sweden need to undergo profound change? Sweden is a country that's sitting in the north of Europe, It doesn't have any particular enemies. It is a quiet place. Why does it need to undergo profound change? Why? So there's something to sit and ponder. And then Spector says that she sees this resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this time, Europe has not yet learned how to become multicultural. We will be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. And then she has some problems with words, because she then talks in an uncomfortable way and she says, Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies they once were in the last century. And I think that what she's really trying to avoid saying is that Europe is not going to be the white societies, the pure white societies they once were in the last century. So she substitutes this weird word, monolithic, in there in order to avoid saying white. I think white and pure, I think that's what she's trying to stay away from, and she has to do some juggling with words in order to say that. And then she goes on to say, Jews are going to be at the center of that. Jews are going to be at the center of all this change, okay? It's going to be a huge transformation for Europe to make. So here is this one ragtag Jew coming from Israel suddenly talking about how all of Europe must change. And it goes on, they are now going into a multicultural mode and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive. So I just want to unpack that as well. She's saying that Europe is going to go into a multicultural mode and Jews will be resented. Well, I can explain why people experience hostility. In all animals, which includes humans, you will get angry and you will begin to hate and express anger when you feel that something is threatening you. When something threatens you, your natural reactions kick in and you start to hate it and you start to say things about it, etc. So when she says Jews will be resented because of our leading role, she's almost admitting to the fact that the stuff that she's going to do and that Jews are going to do are going to be disliked. People are going to hate it, and that they will be resented because of this nasty thing that is happening to them. But of all the stuff she says a most important thing. She says, but without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive. So let me repeat that. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive. What the hell is this? Before we unpack that, I just want to take a step back. Let's look again at Barbara Spector. Barbara Spector is in Sweden. Barbara Spector is busy teaching. Remember, like the rabbi, we will teach you. So she's teaching. That's what she's there for. She is there to teach these whites something. And the core of what she's going to be teaching has to do with multiculturalism. And Europe is going to change. And Jews are going to be there helping Europe to change. But this teaching thing that she's doing is something the government is even paying for. Isn't that crazy? So she's teaching these whites multiculturalism, and the government is actually paying her to do that. So what I want to point out to you here is something that we're going to return to, because this comes up in liberalism. And the issue at hand is what is said at a high level. What are the things that are discussed behind closed doors at a high level in governments and places of power in the Western world? And this Barbara Spector is giving us some insight into what is said behind closed doors. Because she says, and this is the key thing, without that transformation, Europe will not survive. So what the hell is this? I'm telling you that my analysis is that these Jews are busy messing with everybody's head at a very high level. At a very, very high level, Jews are engaging in arguments, and those arguments and those discussions are about things that you and I aren't going to hear in the mass media. But the crux of what she's hinting at is that somehow Europe is going to be destroyed if it remains white. That's really what this boils down to. Europe is going to lose out and fall apart if it remains white. And the way to save Europe is to make it multicultural. But hold on, what about the Kalergi plan and all those Jews from the 1920s who were saying that if you want to destroy Europe, you must bring in other races, interbreed the people, and then that is how you destroy all the whites. What about that? Well, that seems to be forgotten. That seems to be forgotten. But the way liberalism presents the story here, the storyline, is that whites in Europe are not capable of surviving if they remain white. So isn't this an interesting thing? You can get the Kalergi plan implemented by whites against themselves if they believe some other story. If whites believe that multiculturalism has some kind of survival benefit, then whites will implement it. But something there is very, very screwy. Very, 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 very screwy. And I just want to make that clear to you. But notice in this screwy plan that, hey, in walk the Jews, and the Jews are saying, we're here to help you. We are here to save your country, and we're here to even save all of Europe. And we will lead you, and that is how we're going to save Europe. But the plan that's being implemented is not going to save Europe. The plan that's going to be implemented is going to destroy Europe. So this is an example of mismanagement, but notice how the mismanagement takes place. It is done on the basis of some other weird thinking, which is liberal thinking, but I'm not going to discuss it here. But just keep this in mind, because I will be revisiting this, because this is at the heart of a lot of liberal stuff, even in America, especially in America, actually, that there is other thinking that's taking place, but you are not privy to that thinking. But notice the Jew walking in all confident like, oh, we need to save you. I can save you. I can save all of your civilization, but you must pay us some money, and we want the government to sponsor our organization, and you're going to learn from Jews. You're going to have Jewish learning. But is Jewish learning actual learning, or is Jewish learning something completely different? But notice the leading role that this Jewess is playing, and that Jews are going to be playing. Again, that top down, we are special, we are superior, we know better than you. With great confidence, I might add. So, some things to sit and think about. In those three videos, you've seen the rabbis doing their little storyline, and the rabbis are constantly harping on their higher links back to God and how they know better and will teach you. And here she is also on a religious maneuver, Aliyah, yeah? And she's now suddenly teaching the Swedes, teaching from various quotes, Jewish learning. So there are a bunch of things there for you to sit and ponder, because we're going to talk a little bit more about other things now. And I should add that, notice, these Jews are not teaching us, quotes, spiritual stuff. These Jews are walking in real life, in real life situations, and they're like, we're here to teach you. You know, we know better than you. We, the Jewish people, know things that, you know, you dumb, retarded Europeans don't know, and we are going to teach you. Notice that approach. Notice that approach. It hit me that there's another good example of a Jewish term where they could have used an English word or similar word in any other European language, for example. That word is anti-Semitism, the term anti-Semitism. And the term anti-Semitism is something I've thought about a lot. And what anti-Semitism basically boils down to is that anti-Semitism means the enemy of the Jews. That's what an anti-Semite is. An anti-Semite is someone who is an enemy of the Jews. And that is why the Jews have all these weird debates about what is an anti-Semite, because they actually have enemies that come in so many different forms. And they themselves come up with a definition, and then they find another enemy popping up from another angle. But at the end of the day, if you look at anti-Semitism, at the end of the day, anti-Semitism is something that is defined only by Jews. And anti-Semites are always people that have got some kind of prejudice against the Jews and are even open enemies of the Jews. But basically, Jews are defining who their enemy is. Oh, that guy's an enemy. That guy's an enemy. That other guy's an enemy. But they don't use the term enemy. They say, oh, no, he's an anti-Semite, anti-Semite. And they're always on the lookout for, you know, who's an anti-Semite? Oh, that guy's an anti-Semite. I remember when I used to know Jews, one day a Jew that I knew well spoke about another white guy. And he said, oh, you know, that guy was such a good guy. And then suddenly he changed and he became a raging anti-Semite. And at the time, I didn't even know, you know, what do you mean, a raging anti-Semite? What is that? Well, they must be talking about me like that these days. Ah, you remember Jan Lamprecht? He's now a wild, raging anti-Semite. Oh, he's off the charts, you know, probably saying things like that. But anti-Semitism is basically Jews defining their enemy. So why is it necessary for them to use a weird word when a simple English word would do? They just turn around and say, these people are our enemies, and, you know, these people need to be stopped or fought or whatever. But I think that there's a lot of deeper thoughts that need to go into the fact of why Jews use their own terms instead of terms that would be easy to understand and quite clear. And it could be that they need to hide certain things. So they talk to each other and they know what this means, and it's like a code word. And it could also be that having their weirdo terms allows them to go and talk to people, especially people in high places, and sound intellectual, and they say, oh, you see, there are these people that are anti-Semites, and then the person in a high position would say, what's an anti-Semite? Why is he an anti-Semite? Blah, blah, blah. But it's all this Jewish weirdness, and maybe it gets the mileage. Because ultimately, it might just be that whites are more easily manipulated when they are dealing with the weird and the unknown. And then it might even be an easier sell to the public. Oh, we got to help the Jews. We got to help the Jews because they got this problem with anti-Semites. When in fact, if you just said it openly the proper way, then it would be, oh, you see, we got to send in the army and the air force to the Middle East to go and kill all those Arabs because we need to kill the enemies of the Jews. That's really what this is about. You know, we need to go and kill the Nazis because they are the enemies of the Jews. So if you maybe came out openly and said, you see, our military and our government exists and will always run around killing the enemies of Jews, you know, then people would start asking questions, you know, is the British military and the American military, the Royal Navy, the US Navy, the US Air Force, the Marines, what are these? Are these like soldiers for hire who will always go and kill for Jews? Is that what we really are? We're running like a mercenary outfit where we will send our troops in to go and kill the enemies of Jews. You know, maybe if you used easier to understand terms, people would turn around and say, well, if these are your enemies, it's your problem, it's not our problem. Don't make your problem our problem. But if you approach it in this weirdo way, maybe you can get more mileage. I am running a little bit off topic in this regard, but I am just asking the question, why do Jews use their terms and their words when we have terms that are quite clear and concise and well understood that could actually take the place of quite a number of their weirdo terms? Another way of looking at it is to turn around and say, them coming with their weirdo terms takes us right back to those rabbis and to Barbara Spector, is that if they come with their weirdo terms and their weirdo language when it's not necessary, it may be just another example of them pulling rank. You know, we're superior to you, you know, to sort of talking in an arrogant way. Oh, we're superior to you. You don't know anything. And here's this word for you, anti-Semitism. Ha! You don't know what anti-Semitism is. Ah, you're an idiot. You see, if you were like us, you were people like us who are close to God, etc., then, you know, you would understand our stuff, you know. Clearly you're uneducated and we need to educate you into our ways, okay? So some kind of approach like that they come from a top-down point of view and then they toss in all their junk stuff into our language and suddenly we have to learn their terms in order to have a discussion with them when in fact it's not really necessary. And like I say, two very straightforward terms that could be used is Zionism is really Jewish nationalism and anti-Semite is really an enemy of the Jews. It's that simple. There's nothing more to it than that. And that's why they have to define it. Other people can't define it for them because they know who's hostile to them at any point in time or a threat to them. I've sat back many times and thought about the times when I was dealing with my Jewish friend, especially in the final years, like from about 2008 to 2012, when I finally switched over and became Jew-wise. And if I sit and think about it, I always thought that Jews were just other white people with their own religion. And as long as I thought in that mode, which was for most of my life until 2012, as long as I thought in those terms, I never saw Jews as a potential enemy. It was only when finally the penny dropped and I realized that these people that I'm dealing with and that I know, they are actually against my people. They're against my race. They're against my nation. That they're against the whites of South Africa. That they're against my race, the whole white race. And when the penny dropped, it's like, ah, so you're an enemy of mine. And so that might be one of the reasons why Jews are all cagey and using all their weirdo Jew terms and they're moving around like that. Because if they are too open and too easy to understand, then the penny might drop with everybody. And then if everyone knows what they're up to, then everybody would say, ah, okay, so your goal is to totally destroy us and conquer us and own all our shit and, you know, turn us into slaves, etc., kill off our people. Okay, now I get it. All right, you're my enemy. You see, so I think that a lot of this weirdo Jewy crap helps them to come and to do things knowing that they are our enemies, but trying to do things in such a way that the vast majority of us never realize their ultimate malicious goals. I think there is a tremendous amount that they gain from their weirdo, creepy Hebrew, Yiddish stuff. They are a closed society operating in an open society. So whites are the open society, but Jews are the closed society. In fact, that French author, Hilaire Belloc, he actually raised this issue again and again and again in his book. We will get to Hilaire Belloc's book, but in his book, he talks endlessly about the Jews and secrecy and how they are silent and secret, etc. And he raises that issue, that complaint, over and over again. And it's true. It's true to this day. These people are always functioning in secret. Always. But returning to the time when I used to speak to my Jewish friend, and the final years, I think I have thought about this and I've thought back to the things that happened between us and why he did what he did. And I'm convinced that he began to see that I'm becoming more and more right-wing and I'm starting to come up with more and more right-wing things. And I'm starting to have an interest in Hitler and the Nazis. And even before I had an interest in Hitler and the Nazis, he could see that I'm going more and more to the right wing, that this is the direction that I'm heading towards. And he's trying to constantly drive me back to liberalism. But I want to tell you about something he did one day that really caught me off guard. So he would come to my house. Mostly on a Saturday afternoon, we'd have some tea or coffee and we'd have a chat. Little do I know that the real reason he's coming is not because he's really interested in a chat. He's busy trying to change me because I've got a website and I'm heading to the right. I'm heading more and more to the right. And 99% of the time, all his arguments that he was using were liberal arguments. And I've mentioned before, he'd come with his liberal arguments. I would tear them to pieces. I would take my time. I'd listen to what he says, and then I would tear his arguments to shreds. And then the next week when we're talking on the phone or whatever, or the next time I see him, he starts all over again as if he's forgotten that I won the argument last time. I tore all his arguments to shreds, and he's coming at me again as if we haven't had this discussion before. And yet we have had this discussion before many times, and each time I've come back and I've explained to him, this is wrong, that is wrong, that can't work, this is rubbish, etc., etc. But the one day we had a discussion that just caught me off guard. My Jewish friend didn't really know enough about me to understand me from a, let's call it, spiritual point of view. So he kind of saw me as a Christian, even though I never go to church, and even though about the only thing that I might have done that would have made him think like that was that he and I would have arguments over evolution. Back then, I was anti-evolution, and I would argue with him about evolution. So that might have been the closest thing that gave him an indication that I had Christian-like tendencies, let's call it. But later, when I became a total atheist, I'm now pro-evolution and I don't make those arguments anymore. But the irony was that I'd be anti-evolution and he'd be pro-evolution, yet he's going to the synagogue, to shul, as they call it. And he'd be the one telling me that evolution is correct. So it shows you that they also have their own dissonance. They go to the shul and they go to the synagogue and they listen to their rabbis, and their rabbis are telling them all their Jewish stuff and keeping them all together, etc. But it shows you that there are parts of their own story that they don't buy. And in his case, he had a background in biology, and so he totally believed in evolution. So one day, we were sitting in my lounge, and we were doing our normal coffee and tea thing and talking. Like I say, this is like 2011, 2012 or so, very possibly 2012 when this particular conversation happened. That's my best guess. And in some of his conversations, when he wasn't pushing liberalism, he would start telling me and boasting about the power of the Jews. And he'd say, oh, we got somebody in Google. We got somebody in that company. We got somebody over there. You know, we're doing this, we're doing that, and so on. He was trying to impress me with the power of the Jews, and he would tell me a lot of these Jewish stories and say, oh, we got this guy here and that guy there. Oh, you can go look him up. You know, he'd say, that's his name and you can go look it up and he has that position in Google, etc. So he was trying to impress me with stuff like this. Now, interestingly enough, we don't keep track of our own and what our own people are up to. For example, I learned from someone else that there was a Boer who actually had a high position in NASA. There was a Boer who had a high position in NASA. I can't remember his name, but somebody told me about him in recent years. But here are these Jews, and they're keeping track of all their people. And, oh, we're doing this, and this guy's here, and that guy owns that, and did you see that guy starting that? So he was trying to impress me with the power of the Jews and all the things the Jews are doing. But then, on this particular day, he suddenly says something that blew my mind. I can't remember what we were talking about exactly, but at a point, suddenly, out of his mouth, he said something like this. He said, we Jewish people, we've got a direct telephone line to God. And when he said that, I didn't know what the hell to say. He said, and I'll repeat it, he said something along the lines, we Jewish people, we have a direct telephone line to God. Now, when he said that, I was dumbfounded. And I did what I normally do if someone really comes at me with something, you know, out of the left field, that I think this thing is weird and I have so many questions. I decided to just not say anything. I just remained silent. But many things went through my mind. Like, are you saying that you people communicate directly with God? Are you trying to tell me that you can send a message to God and God is going to give you some kind of order back? That was the kind of stuff going through my mind. And when he said a telephone line, I almost was thinking, you are saying to me, you can communicate with God, that you people can communicate with God. You have like a method to communicate with God. How do you do it? Do you have some kind of special technology that allows you to speak to the God of the universe? I was thinking in technological terms. I wasn't thinking in terms of like prayer and you go and you pray to God and you say, oh God, you know, there's this Goyim, his name is Jan, he's a total anti-Semite, he's lost his mind, you know, what shall we do with him? You know, I didn't think like that. When my Jewish friend said, we the Jewish people have a direct telephone line to God, I kind of took it like that, in the same way that the United States has got like a emergency telephone communication with Russia, so the two sides can talk to each other about nuclear stuff if a nuclear war or some kind of huge nuclear thing is going down. So something like that telephone that the president can go and talk to Putin like within 2 minutes kind of a thing. I was sitting and thinking that, you know, if he says a telephone line to God, it sounded really special and it sounded really firm. It wasn't like, I wasn't thinking in terms of your rabbi is going to pray and then maybe he's going to come back and say something. No, the way he said it, we the Jewish people have a direct telephone line to God. That sounded like hectic, okay? It sounded like hectic and firm. Like, we the Jewish people, we speak to God and we get answers straight from God and that's it, okay? So when he said that, I was thinking along the lines of like saying to him, if you have the telephone line to God, what is God's telephone number kind of thing? But I didn't want to say to him, you know, are you serious? How does it work? I was just too dumbfounded at the time to even sit and approach him that way. So I just stayed totally silent and left him to then go and carry on with the discussion in another way. But it blew my mind and it immediately threw me. And I couldn't make head or tail of it that my Jewish friend would say this to me, that, you know, we the Jewish people have got a telephone line straight to God. Like what? You people? Only you people can talk to God? You can actually like talk to God? Almost like, you know, if you want to send a message to the president, you'd write a letter and post it. And, you know, maybe if you're extremely lucky, the president will reply to you. I was like thinking, whoa. It's like he's talking in those kinds of terms. It blew my mind. It rocked me. But I didn't say a word. I was too dumbfounded at the time. And later, as time went by, I thought about this thing. Because in the more than 20 years that I knew him, he'd never said anything like this. Never. And he was very much into history. And like I say, He actually liked science, this particular Jewish friend of mine. He was actually quite a bit into science because he'd gone to university and studied biology and stuff like that. So he used to always talk like sort of intellectual kinds of things. And he was also much older than me. He was like 19 years older than me. So I didn't want to say rude things and that kind of stuff because at that point we were still friends. But I'm kind of skeptical. And this particular discussion and this particular stuff that he said on that particular day, he never repeated it. He only said it that one day, and it blew my mind. I didn't know what to make of it. And also, in the succeeding months, I didn't go back to him and take him up on it. And when I think back to that, I wish I had. I wish I had. But on that day, it was quite something that he came out. Here's this guy who believes in evolution and all that. And suddenly he says to me, we, the Jewish people, we've got a direct telephone line to God. And I just didn't know what to make of it. And later on, as the years went by, I often thought about that strange conversation. And I thought to myself, like, why? Why did he say that to me that day? Why did he say that? Well, nowadays, I think that other Jews must have told him. Because he did make it clear to me that when he goes to shul and they're busy chatting afterwards and they're having tea and cake and all that kind of stuff, he did tell me that he tells other Jews, you know, I've got this friend in the right wing. And he obviously was talking to other Jews about me, and he must have raised many issues about me with the other Jews at the synagogue and saying, oh, this guy, he's starting to become a Nazi. What do I say to him? Blah, blah, blah. And so maybe that is where this telephone line to God thing may have come up as maybe a suggestion by one of the other Jews. And maybe all that stuff about Google and all that, all their people in high places and in multinational companies and the US government, all kinds of stuff that he was saying to impress me. Those kinds of things may have been things that came out of either his own mind or they were suggestions by other Jews. So maybe at a point some Jew said to him, you know, why don't you say we got a direct telephone line to God? Try that line on him. It might work, you know. He sounds like a Christian. He might fall for it kind of thing. So that could have been where that weird thing came from that he said only that one time in the more than 20 years that I knew him. But it was something that I thought about over the years. When I think back to conversations with him, that one really blew my mind. This thing of, you know, we the Jewish people, we've got a direct telephone line to God. But there you can see that those rabbis are basically trying to pull that kind of stunt, you know, earlier in this video where these rabbis are, oh, you know, God, we are closer to God. We are the chosen people. You know, we're closer to God than you, you know. It's a boast. And it's basically pulling out a thing and saying, we are superior to you because we are closer to God. Jews will try many tricks. And you only have to see the efforts of Jews in marketing and the games that they've played in marketing and psychology, the experiments that they have tried, that they have conducted, all the things that they've conducted regarding manipulating other people's minds. And I have raised this issue with regard to their core issue. I did mention this in that video about evolution and Jews. The video I did is called Human Evolution, What Are Jews and Why They Are Very Dangerous. And I basically spelled out that it seems to me that the crux of all Jewish existence is based on Jews manipulating people, that that is their key evolutionary strategy. They manipulate other people. A Jew doesn't go and dig a ditch. The Jew will get you to dig the ditch for him. He may pay you to do it, but that is the way the Jews function. And that would explain why they are so prevalent in things like psychology, etc. And you'll find them in all places where there's management, and even look at law and lawyers. You'll find tons and tons of Jews there. They are there engaging in arguments, etc. Their thing is about speaking and about messing with your head. That's really their thing. The crux of it would be to, you know, look at what Hitler and others have said, that Jews are the greatest liars in the world. They are the greatest liars in history. That is what they do. So that's just another way of just summing the whole thing up, that whether they are playing with you in a subtle way or just cheating you outright, but, you know, whichever one it is all done through communication or miscommunication. And keep these ideas in mind: miscommunication, mismanagement, teaching deliberate falsehoods. Those are things that we whites would never even think of. We'd never even conceive, let's go and we get together and we lie to those people. Let's all work together as a team and we're going to lie to them. We're going to fool them. We would never even think of that. It wouldn't even enter our heads. But the Jews function in a different world. They live in a different world. In recent years, when I was thinking of this telephone line to God story, we, the Jewish people, we've got a direct telephone line to God. I then began to wonder if they have ever said that to anyone else. And I couldn't specifically find examples where they've said that to somebody else in that way. But as you can see, those rabbis are implying that kind of thing, especially that first rabbi. They're implying that, and you can see where this "we are the chosen people" takes you. The moment that you accept the notion that they are the chosen people, then they move up in rank and we are below them. And they are closer to God and we are below them. So they have the edge over us. They are superior. They're playing a game of superiority. They're playing a game of "we are better than you" in the spiritual world. That's what they are playing. So this telephone line to God story basically implies that Jews have a way of speaking to God and God speaks back to them. And if you were talking to God through a telephone, you would talk and say, you know, "Hello, Lord. I got a problem with this guy. His name is Jan." And then the Lord says, you know, "This is what you got to do with this bastard." And, you know, they'd hear it in their ears. So the closest that I came, that I could find, to anyone coming up with a telephone line story was actually a guy who was a former Christian turned atheist. And he was actually a very interesting evangelical Christian, totally devoted to the church, etc. He's an American. His name is Dan Barker. And Dan Barker was a evangelical Christian who was crazy for converting people. He even went and lived in Mexico and was converting people to the Bible. But then what happened was Dan Barker became an atheist over a period of time. And then he started writing books about atheism and he's against religion. And Dan Barker wrote a number of books. And I was going through various books that he wrote. And in one of his books, I came across mention that he had a debate with a guy. And they had a debate, and the guy said that God speaks to him. And then I couldn't remember in which book he had written this. So in the end, after much searching that took me months and I couldn't find this stuff again, I decided to actually write an email to Dan Barker to ask him about this, if he can remember that he spoke to a guy who said that he heard the voice of God. Because I was sure that he heard this from a Jewish guy. And I'd hunted high and low through his books to try and find this story of the Jewish guy that he'd spoken to who told him that he heard the voice of God. And Dan Barker wrote back to me, and I want to read you his email. This is what Dan Barker wrote back to me. He said, "Jan, nice to hear from you. I don't remember that story about the Jew, but that doesn't mean I didn't write about it. I do remember writing about a debate I did with a person who said he hears an audible voice of God, but he was a Christian. He had converted from Judaism, so perhaps that is what you remember. Here is a story about the debate before it happened." He actually gave me two links to his website, but those links are no longer valid. However, I now know who the guy is, and the guy that he was speaking to, the quote's Christian, okay? But I put Christian in inverted commas. The quote's Christian that he spoke to is Bob Siegel, but Bob Siegel is actually a Jew who converted to Christianity. And Bob Siegel hears the voice of God. He hears it audibly, unlike the rest of the Christians. This former Jew, he says he hears the voice of God. So it sounds very similar to the kind of thing that my Jewish friend was kind of angling me towards. And this Bob Siegel says that God's voice is a baritone. That is what God sounds like. And he knows because he says he's heard it. As I said, when my Jewish friend said to me that he speaks to God, I didn't know what to ask him. However, when Dan Barker faced the same situation, he actually did come back and ask the guy a question. And I really think that when we look at a guy like Bob Siegel, that what you're looking at is a Jew who, quotes, converted to Christianity, but he's kept certain Jewishness with him. And that some things that he had in his Jewish background clearly is stuff that he's used in Christianity. So if you look at the screen in front of you, you'll see the actual quotes from a screenshot that I took of a book written by Dan Barker where he mentions this discussion. And this screenshot that you see in front of you is from the book Godless by Dan Barker. And this is in chapter 4. So this is what Dan Barker wrote. "Some opponents have made comments that are just plain nutty. At Arizona State University, Bob Siegel, a former Jew who is now a Christian minister and radio talk show host, claimed that one of the evidences for the existence of God is that God talks to him personally." And we are talking about talking as in you are hearing him through your ears. So Dan writes, "God talks to you?" I asked. "Yes, he does. What does his voice sound like? Is God a tenor or a baritone?" because Dan Barker has got a musical background. He's a baritone, Bob replied. Audience gasps. The voice of God sounds very much like the voice of Bob Siegel. So that is Dan Barker's sort of sarcastic remark to what Bob Siegel told him. At least Dan Barker went further than I did in asking about when you speak to God personally and you can hear him through your ears, you know, get a little bit more info. And this is what came out of it. I don't know if anyone will ever be able to find a video of that debate. Bob Siegel does have his own radio show, and you can actually phone Bob Siegel. You can call in on Bob Siegel's show if you really want to. If anyone has the desire to do so, to phone Bob Siegel and ask him about speaking to God, that could be interesting. I was thinking of actually going to those lengths, but then I thought, ah, no, I don't think it's that important. But if one wanted to, I'm sure you could get quite a story out of Bob if you got him talking. At least, therefore, I can find some kind of proof that somebody else has had an experience almost similar to what I've had, and that this person has documented that experience. So I was grateful to Dan Barker for confirming this, and then I was able to find it in his book. But as you can see, it's a Christian who's not really a normal Christian, a white Christian. This is a Jew who converted to Christianity. So I think this is an example of some of that Jewishness, talking to God, we are the people of God kind of stuff coming through there. Here's a video of Bob Siegel giving a talk to Christians. And the video is 9 minutes long. And in this video, he talks a lot about how can you tell the difference between God's voice and Satan's voice. But you will see that he's mostly telling you that you don't hear God's voice, you have thoughts in your head. So listen to Bob Siegel and get a bit of a feel for what this guy is like. Here's the video.
Welcome to Today Matters. Boy, do I have a scripture from you, a blessing from God and an interference from Satan. Now look, I never assume what everybody in an audience believes. I know some of you don't believe in Satan. You don't take him seriously. The Bible does say that there is a person known as Satan. He's an enemy of God, a spiritual being. He tries to keep people from walking with God. He tempts people to sin. He tries to keep people from giving their life to Jesus Christ. And he exists in some kind of unseen dimension. It's not just him personally. When the Bible says Satan put it upon a person's heart, that's something we read from time to time. It's not necessarily Satan himself. He has a whole minion of other spiritual creatures known as demons. Look, if you don't believe in Satan, put a peg on that. I'd be happy to talk to you sometime. Satan exists. Demons exist. It has been documented. Demons have been cast out. For those of you that want to say it's all psychological, there are psychologists and psychiatrists themselves who have documented the difference between emotional mental illness and demonic activity. That's not our subject for today, but I wanted to give you that disclaimer. For the rest of the time, I'm going to be talking, assuming that you believe both God and Satan exist. And if you don't believe that, stick around. You might just learn something. Anyway, we'll start with Matthew chapter 16. I'm going to read verses 15 through 17, then I'm going to skip to verse 21 and continue. Jesus is here. He's with his disciples. And there's a lot of discussion of who is this Jesus? He's done all kinds of miracles. So he's putting the question to his own disciples. They've talked about the fact that different people have different rumors about who he is. And he wants to know what they think. He said to them, he meaning Jesus, "But who do you yourselves say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. From that time, Jesus began to point out to his disciples that it was necessary for him to go to Jerusalem and to suffer many things from the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and to be killed and to be raised up on the third day. Yet Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's purposes, but men's. Boy, talk about a roller coaster of emotions. How would you like to have been Peter on that day? This conversation started out great, didn't end up like that. Peter just thought he was giving an opinion. Who do I think you are? I think you're the Christ. Christ is a word for Messiah, means anointed one, once sent from God. This was the person that the Jews had been expecting for century after century. And Jesus is saying, in my opinion, that's who you are. And Jesus is saying, it's not just your opinion. That was revealed to you by my Father in heaven. Now, when we get into the mystery of the Trinity, the Father commands the words, but it was actually the Spirit of God, the third person of the Trinity, whom we call the Holy Spirit, that would have revealed that to Peter. Later, Peter and the rest of the disciples and anybody that gives their life to Christ over the years is going to have a relationship with this Holy Spirit. He's going to live inside of them as a personal guardian. However, that wasn't going on yet. Peter did not yet have that kind of relationship, but the Spirit still existed, obviously. He's God. He was in the world. He at times put thoughts in people's minds. And this means that sometimes the thoughts in your mind, you think they're coming from you, they're really coming from God. Jesus promised this to his disciples that when he goes away, the Holy Spirit's going to come more permanently. During the Last Supper, when he's giving kind of his farewell State of the Union address, he's saying, you're sad that I'm going away. It's a good thing because after I leave, the Holy Spirit will come. I don't know about you, but I used to often think, boy, wouldn't it have been something to be one of those disciples to follow Jesus around for all these many, many years? Well, yeah, that sounds exciting. It didn't work out that well for all of them, though, did it? There's this guy named Judas. So apparently being around Jesus those many years did not make that much of a difference. But here's the interesting thing. Jesus is saying, when the Holy Spirit comes, it's even going to be better than all these special effects because God's going to be living inside of you. It will be subtle, but the God of the universe will pass his thoughts through your mind. So here Peter thinks he's giving an opinion, and Jesus is basically saying, Peter, you don't realize it, but you just prophesied. Those words, they came into your thoughts. They actually came from God. That's exciting. Now, as I mentioned, however, Satan can put thoughts in our minds too, or one of his demons working under him. Look how fast Peter accidentally changed channels. He's all excited, and Jesus is telling him, you identified who I was. You thought it was your opinion. You're a prophet, and Peter's getting on a roll. He's getting kind of excited, like, whoa, I'm a prophet. Well, while I'm here prophesying, Lord, I declare you will not go into Jerusalem and die. This will not happen. And now Jesus is saying, boy, a minute ago you were listening to God. Now you're listening to Satan. Now, if this sounds kind of freaky, relax, because there are ways to discern the difference between God's voice and Satan's voice. But yes, let's be clear. Sometimes your thoughts are your own. Most of the time, 90% of the time, obviously your thoughts are your own. Sometimes they come from God, and sometimes they come from this other source, the demonic world. So how do you know the difference? Well, one's obvious. One's right here. Jesus just said himself that he was going to go to Jerusalem and die and rise from the dead. If Jesus was really who Peter thought he was, he should have trusted Jesus. So if you're getting thoughts that contradict the word of God, if you're getting thoughts that contradict Jesus or what Jesus and his Father said, you know right away. But there's another way. And this has to do in our interaction with God. This has to do with the realm where Satan tries to influence us the most, temptation. I'm going to tell you how you can tell the difference between God's voice and Satan's voice before you sin and after you sin. I know you're not planning on sinning today. Either am I, but who are we kidding? It could happen. All right. Before you sin, Satan is the nice voice, the friendly voice, the permissive voice. Oh, come on. It's not that big of a deal. Everybody does it. And even if it's wrong for most people, you're a special case. God understands your unique situation. Go on. It won't be so bad. He's the friendly voice before you sin. Satan, he's the friendly voice before you sin. God, on the other hand, is the harsh voice before you sin. You don't want to do this. I told you it's wrong. I'm commanding you not to do this. Don't do this. Oh, you did it. Then, after you sin, the voices coming through our thoughts go through a role reversal. After you sin, God is the friendly, merciful one. God's going, all right, you did it. I wish you hadn't done that. I tried to stop you, but you have free will. Okay, it's all right. Not all right in the sense that I approve, but all right in the sense that I still love you. You're still my son. You're still my daughter. Jesus still died for you. You're still going to go to heaven. Let's get up. Let's try it again. We can still have a good relationship. It's okay. That's God after you've sinned. Satan, after you sin, he was the guy that said, go ahead and do it. After you sin, he's going, oh my goodness gracious. What in the heavenlies just happened here? You sinned? How could you have done that? Never mind that he was the one that talked you into it a second ago. What? How could you have done that? And you call yourself a Christian. You're scum. I know God talks about forgiving, but he's not going to forgive your sin. He'll forgive everybody but you. You might as well just pack it in, dude. Don't even try walking with God today. And that's how you tell the difference between God's voice and Satan's voice. Before the sin, God is stern. Satan is permissive. After the sin, Satan condemns and accuses, and God reminds you that you're forgiven. God bless.
I cut out a 5-minute section out of a full show that Bob Siegel did. The full show is 43 minutes long. And it covers many topics, and he interviews people, etc. But I cut out 5 minutes of it because in those 5 minutes, he discusses this whole issue of people hearing God's voice audibly. And I believe that Vice President Mike Pence in America may have said that he's heard God's voice or Jesus' voice. But anyway, the point here is simply that you can hear the arguments that the former Jew, Bob Siegel, makes about God speaking to people audibly now. As I mentioned when I asked the Christians that I knew, they had no problem with God speaking in the Bible to people in the past, but they did not think that God ever spoke audibly to them now. Whereas if you listen to Bob Siegel's arguments, you'll see that Bob Siegel now tries to use those arguments of modern times, and he says, oh, now you're discrediting the Bible, etc. But you can see, the point of this is just to show you that the kind of stuff that Dan Barker was telling us about Bob Siegel, that it looks like Bob Siegel really is a guy who would probably at some point have said that God speaks to him. So it does look like Dan Barker's story is real, that during his debate, that it does look likely that this Bob Siegel could very well have made that kind of statement, that he hears God. So I couldn't get actual video footage of Bob Siegel saying that he hears God, but I think when you've listened to this 5-minute discussion, you'll see that I think Dan Barker's got him right, and that this is the kind of guy who would go and make that kind of argument. And the rest of the stuff he says about the Bible, we're not here to debate that. So just listen to the 5 minutes. It's quite an interesting discussion.
At least from the likes of another celebrity who wants to lecture us about appropriate and inappropriate religious claims. Jimmy wasn't alone this week. We were also treated to the intellect of Joy Behar on ABC's The View. Joy Behar says it's okay to talk to Jesus, but claiming to hear him talk to you is a sign of mental illness. Now, while she was specifically referring to our vice president, Joy's insightful commentary has far deeper implications. It's doubtful that she took the time to consider them. In one thoughtless, irresponsible comment, she accuses most of the New Testament writers who claim to have both heard, seen, and interacted with the resurrected Jesus of being mentally ill. And what does this say of Jesus himself, who promised that his spirit would come after he left and speak to the apostles? What does it say of Jesus when he said to Peter, "Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven"? Meanwhile, her words, if applied consistently, do not say much for Old Testament prophets either, prophets such as Moses, Jeremiah, and virtually every author of the Old Testament, who also claimed to have heard directly from God. As a matter of fact, the very belief in a collection of writing called Scripture is based upon the assumption that God spoke. Thus, one who says it is okay to believe in Jesus or have a little bit of religion is saying it is okay to believe in a God who at the very least spoke in the past. And such a person will have a difficult time explaining why this same God cannot or would not continue to speak. While I will not accuse Miss Behar of being mentally ill herself, extending far more grace to her than she is extending to Vice President Pence, I will challenge her to at least activate her brain before activating her mouth. For one thing, the amount of proof that Joy or anybody has which concludes that God does not speak to people is zero. And the notion of a God who creates human beings with an ability to speak but who does not choose to speak himself is rather flimsy philosophically. Certainly, God is capable of doing anything we can do. Once we have established that he can talk, there is only one remaining question. What would be his reason for not talking? And when somebody claims that he has, what is the opposing evidence that he hasn't? On to other news. Regarding my comments about Joy Behar and the phenomenon of God speaking, which I spoke about a few moments ago in my monologue and wrote about this week on Facebook, many people on Facebook liked what I had to say, including Christine, Jim, Patty, Fran, Allison, Rachel, Linda, Nileen, Dan, and many, many, many others. D says, "Nicely reasoned and well said, Bob. Jesus is, after all, the Word, and all creation was spoken into existence. I pray God uses this in her life to draw her to his Word. Hopefully she will hear from him herself one day." Gary says, "Behar is obviously spiritually blind." And then he quotes from Daniel chapter 12. "Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." And then Gary adds, "Some of us get it." Nancy says, "I thought the rule was no one was allowed to say anything negative about a person's religion. Isn't that hate talk? Good grief." Well, Nancy, I believe that's only the rule when people criticize Islam, or more correctly put, that's the rule when people criticize any religion other than Christianity. It's always open season on Christians. See how it works? James says, "God talks to us believers as we read his word. We talk to God as we pray to Jesus. Seems to be Joy doesn't own a holy Bible." Well, actually, James, I think Joy was objecting to anyone who would claim they heard God talk in some context outside reading the Bible, such as hearing an audible voice the way Moses and others did. But frankly, God can still do that. God can do whatever he wants. He does not need to check with us first. He certainly doesn't need to check with Joy Behar. Welcome back to 1170 The Answer. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. I was reading some Facebook responses to my monologue, specifically the part about Joy Behar saying it's okay to talk to God, but there's something kind of wacky if we claim God is talking to us. Teddy says, "She seems to have a heart of stone, lost in the desert, lacks wisdom, and perhaps a bit jealous. I pray Jesus speaks to her soon. She listens and obeys." Now that would be an interesting episode of The View. That would be interesting. Teddy, what would also be interesting is for us to all go out ice skating, because on that day, I think hell will have frozen over. But what do I know? People said that about the Apostle Paul, and he gave his life to Christ. Sharon says, "Another question is, when will Miss Behar take the time to listen? Perhaps if she listened more than spoke, she would find out a whole lot of truth from God. Of course, listening does apply to all of us. That it does, Sharon. Michael says, didn't Paul say in Galatians that he was given the gospel directly by revelation from God and not by talking to any man?
If you want to compare the way that Bob Siegel speaks with the way other Christians, especially white Christians, speak, here are two videos that were pretty popular on YouTube. And in these two videos, these guys are talking about how can you tell if God is speaking to you? And you will see that both of them, despite having slightly different arguments, you'll see that to them, things like thoughts, random thoughts in their head, indicates to them that God is speaking to them. And the other thing that's also happening is the one guy takes the Bible as the guiding principle. So those kinds of things are the things that make them know that God is speaking to them. But they do not at all refer to or indicate that God speaks to them in an audible voice. In fact, you'll see that their notion of how God speaks to them is so subtle. It's so very subtle. What's the difference? Can I tell the difference between my random thoughts and a thought that came from God? That is the way that they look at this whole thing. And it's completely different to the former Jew, Bob Siegel. Completely different. He's talking in a whole other way. This is just to confirm again the same things that Christians that I know personally told me. But here you'll hear it out of the mouths of Christians themselves. And this should show you that we are not dealing with telephone lines to God and God's voice coming in through your ears. Definitely not.
Four ways the Holy Spirit speaks. First, the Holy Spirit speaks through the Word. This is the primary way He speaks. If you don't know the Word, you can't discern His voice. Second, the Holy Spirit speaks through wisdom. Now, wisdom isn't necessarily a specific instruction, but rather a godly way of reasoning. Wisdom is sharpened by the Word. Third, the Holy Spirit speaks through the whisper. This is His personal instruction to you. This is necessary for you to receive direction for very specific situations in your life. The whisper is not as reliable as the Word or wisdom because it can be clouded by your own thoughts and emotions. Now, many believers make the mistake of trying to live by the whisper first instead of the Word and wisdom as foundations. And finally, the Spirit speaks through wonders. Wonders include prophetic words, miracles, dreams, visions, and the like. Ground yourself in the Word to properly discern wonders.
How do I differentiate God's voice from intrusive thoughts? Here's a rule. I learned this about dreams when I was a kid. I used to do this thing where you'd realize you were dreaming. What do they call it? Lucid dreaming? When I was like 10, you know, I would realize I was dreaming and then I would just go and start flying. I had this rule though, because I would be dreaming and I couldn't tell if I was dreaming or not. And one of the ways I decided to tell if I was dreaming or not was, if I can't tell if I'm dreaming or not, it means I'm dreaming. And this was an interesting rule. I haven't had those kinds of dreams in my adult life, but the idea is sound, because when I'm awake, I always know I'm awake. I never am like, am I dreaming right now? At least not for me. My thought is this: when God speaks to you, it should be more like being awake than dreaming. It should be like, God's speaking to me. It's very clear. I know it. And if I'm unclear, God, you can speak clearer, because bear with me, Lord, forgive me, but I don't want to confuse your voice with my heart, your voice with my random thoughts. So if I'm in doubt, I'm going to presume it's me, unless I know for sure it's the Lord.
So that's the closest that I can find of someone who had some kind of experience close to that which I had. And that is Dan Barker's experience with the former Jew, Bob Siegel. But you know, if you look at whites and you see how we think, we are interested in reality and we take things seriously. But let me show you the kind of shit that can come out of Jews' mouths. And I'm not just talking any Jew. I'm talking Jews who are like rabbis and stuff. and the kind of crap that will come out of their own mouths, even to their own kind. I'm going to show you a little video. It's a short video. It's less than a minute long. And these old guys in this video appear to me to be rabbis. If they're not rabbis, they certainly look like rabbis. But they are senior Jewish men, and they are talking to young Jews, and they are talking about the Messiah that these Jews are waiting for, this Messiah that Jews have been waiting for so freaking long that never comes to save them, okay? So they are waiting for this Messiah, and they're constantly talking about this Messiah. And here, you are going to hear out of the mouths of Jews, these older Jewish men with the younger Jews, and you're going to hear these older Jews saying to the younger Jews, the Messiah is here. The Messiah is here. It's not like the Messiah is coming. He's already here on earth. And then the young Jews say, like, but if he's on earth, you know, like, where is he? And then they say that the Messiah is the rabbi. And then the other young Jews are like, okay, the Messiah is supposed to be in control of the world, but if he's the rabbi, why isn't the rabbi in control of the world? So just watch this totally nonsensical inter-Jew discussion that makes no sense at all, because there's no way you could say that the Messiah is here, least of all that they even know that the Messiah is their rabbi, whoever the hell he is. So just listen to this total garbage that can come out of these Jews' mouths. And it's not young Jews that are saying it, it's senior old Jews. I'm not sure if they are rabbis. They certainly look like it, but maybe they're just not. But they are saying, oh, well, our rabbi, he's the Messiah. He's here. He's in control of the world. Now, what kind of crap is that? Listen to this.
So when Messiah comes, the Jews will be the leaders then. They will be in power?
The Messiah will be the king.
On the
world. Messiah is here.
He's here already?
Messiah is here.
But we don't know where he is. He's hiding?
Messiah is the rabbi.
Oh, is he? Is this the rabbi?
The rabbi is Messiah, yeah.
Are you sure?
Sure.
Oh, wow. So he's back.
The Messiah is ready here. According to this sector of Judaism, the Messiah is ready here. And it's this
no,
rabbi.
But he's saying the Messiah is this rabbi here.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So how come he's not in control of the whole world then?
All right, but he's come back. He's in the control. Believe me, it's in the control.
Okay.
Also, for you not say him here, or I not say him, or this man not say him, he's in the control.
So, which rabbi is it? What's his name? That is
the Lubavitch Rabbi.
Rabbi?
Lubavitch Rabbi.
Okay.
So, and I came in and seen also.
So, how was that video, hey? I mean, it's hard to believe the kind of crap they talk. And in this case, they're even talking it to their own people. And just to confirm, this video is of these Chabad Lubavitch Jews. In other words, tunnel Jews. And here's the tunnel Jew basically saying at the end of it that the Messiah is one of the Chabad rabbis. So the Messiah is here, and one of the Chabad rabbis is the Messiah. Oh, please, man. For goodness sakes, man. What a bunch of crap. And they're trying to be impressive. You know, many times when I look at these Jews are like a bunch of misfits, okay? In the Great Jewish Mosque, and I will return to the Great Jewish Mosque because I think there are quite a few little bits and pieces there that I need to show people what I subsequently discovered. The Great Jewish Mosque was written by some Russians who moved to America after the insane horror of Bolshevism came to Russia. And those Russians were clearly very educated and very interested in archaeology in the past. And they refer to the Jews as a childish people. And I must tell you that when I look at Jews, I see them as misfits and a childish people. These are an unserious people. And when you actually look deeper into their history and their behavior in Europe, these people really do not belong as citizens in a Western country. These people are just here to mulch off of people. They're not a serious people, and they don't have the characteristics that you need to really do something great. When I look at all kinds of things that I've read about Jews in various books, I must tell you, I don't see these people as admirable in any way. And then, this bunch of people in the past were probably laughed at and scorned because their values and their behavior show their character to be garbage. But they have learned the art of talking big, and nobody talks bigger than them. And of course, you can't go bigger than God, you know, the God of the universe, the God who made everything and controls everything. That's as high as you can go, right? So they use that stuff and they pretend that they know things and can do things. And in the Great Jewish Mosque, those guys were talking about how Jews cannot create, they only imitate. And the more I look at this, the more I say to myself that you're just looking at a bunch of childish people with big mouths talking big stuff, but in reality, they are nothing like us, and they could never have the kind of achievement that we have. They are not capable of it. Let's turn our attention to someone who is very serious and very clever, and who I have a lot of admiration for, and that is Ben Klassen of the Church of Creativity. And what I want to do is I want to read to you from the start of one of the chapters from his book, Nature's Eternal Religion, because Ben sums up a lot of things about the Jews, and then I want to show you something very special that's hidden in Ben Klassen's writing. So, let's go. Ben writes, "As we have seen from the history of the white race and of the Jewish race, the Jews, throughout their long and tortuous history, have been the supreme masters of deceit, whereas the Egyptians are no more, the Babylonians have disappeared, the original Greeks were mongrelized, the Romans perished. The Jews, on the other hand, are alive today and going strong. They are, in fact, now in control of the world." Let me just pause there for a second, because Jews love to boast about how everyone else has come and gone, but the Jews are still here. I remember in the days when I knew Jews, they used to pass emails to each other, and I remember seeing some kind of email exactly along these lines, where the Jews are boasting, "Oh, the Romans are gone, the Greeks are gone, this one is gone, but we Jews, we're still around." That's actually not a valid comparison. Like with all their stuff, there's propaganda in there. That would be, for example, like saying that there is a Chinese dynasty, I don't know the names of the different dynasties, let's say the Ming dynasty. That would be like turning around and saying, "Well, the Ming dynasty is gone, but we Jews are still here." Well, the Ming dynasty may be gone, but all the Chinese are still there. So it's really not a valid comparison. The Chinese people are still there in the same territory that they were in, you know, thousands of years ago. And their government may be different now, but they are still there. So it's not a valid comparison. You could turn around and say, you know, the Jews had some settlement somewhere, and that settlement no longer exists, and you'd end up with exactly the same thing. In fact, the Jews don't have anything that is as big or magnificent as any of these empires that they are boasting about, that they are gone. The Jews never had something like the Babylonian Empire. They never had anything like what the Egyptians had, or the Greeks, or the Romans. They never had any of that. You know, they were mostly a bunch of mongrels moving around in other people's civilizations. So it's some nice feel-good Jewish nonsense for Jews, but it's not a correct comparison. And there are people who have pointed out, for example, we, all of us in the modern Western world, we are all Romans, actually. And let me tell you, that comparison is quite a shocking and amazing comparison when you go down that path, which we will. We're going to get there. Because when you go and look at all the things that we have today that come directly from the Roman Empire, then you will actually be shocked at how much we today are actually like the Romans. The existence of America, all of America, is built on the Roman Republic. That is what the founding fathers of America wanted for America. And let's say you turned around and said, oh, the German tribes are gone, but we Jews are still around. Well, you know, again, total nonsense comparison. The German tribes morphed into all kinds of other countries until it eventually became Germany. And Germany itself has morphed and changed, not always willingly, because we're talking about the quotes allies, but Germany itself has gone through various changes, yet the German people are still there. The German people are still there in the same country, and there they are. So, you know, this is one of those nonsense comparisons. Maybe in the case of the Egyptians and the Middle East, maybe in those cases you are looking at things that have collapsed and those people there never rebuilt the same kind of thing. Or those people also were mongrelized, etc., etc. But really not a valid comparison. And you've got to be careful of some of this propaganda and feel-good nonsense that moves around, and it catches lots of people. I remember reading stuff like this 20 years ago. Jews were emailing this kind of stuff to each other. And for all of this to imply that, you know, whites are somehow a broken people, it's actually not true. We might not have the same centralized structure that we had under the Roman Empire, but we are still very powerful, and we morphed into something else as well. We morphed and changed into multiple other nations. We adopted another religion. We changed, but we're still here, very much. 600 million of us are still here. So we are a much larger number than we were 2,000 years ago. But anyway, let's continue. Why is it that this miserable race, which could never even found a culture or a civilization or manage to build a country of their own, has nevertheless come out on top? If we analyze Jewish history, the answers are not too hard to come by. There are hundreds of reasons that could be listed, but basically they are these few. Number one. Early in their history, now listen to this carefully, early in their history, they recognized what a powerful weapon was religion, a weapon which to unite their own race and a weapon with which to destroy their enemies. Two, they learned that in racial unity there is strength. They have been fanatically dedicated to their own race. Three, they found there is nothing more potent in unifying a group nation, or race than hating a common enemy. As a consequence, all non-Jewish peoples have perpetually been their enemies and always will be. See, this is, quotes, anti-Semitism. Jews will define all the people who are their enemies, and ultimately, as Ben Klassen says, these people are against all the non-Jews. 4. The Jews mastered the tricky technique of confuse, divide, and conquer as a key in overcoming their enemies. That's a pretty deep observation that. Well worth revisiting. Number 5. They have relentlessly organized. They have organized their own people into thousands of effective and all-encompassing groups. They also organized their enemies for their own destruction. So let's just pause there. That's an interesting one. They have also organized their enemies for their own destruction. Cast your thoughts back to Barbara Spector and what I mentioned earlier in this video about the Jews coming to mismanage or miseducate or misdirect the whites of Sweden. 6. They have been diabolically clever at propaganda. They have grasped early in their history what a powerful tool was propaganda with which to manipulate their enemies. You keep 6 in mind there. That's a very important point. So that is the list of 6. And then Ben Klassen carries on. It is this last aspect we want to examine more thoroughly. Whereas the Jews are in complete control of today's propaganda and news media, radio, television, motion pictures, newspapers, magazines, etc., they were already extremely adept at using propaganda before the modern means were even invented. Now listen to this. This comes out of the Bible, and Ben Klassen quotes it. Manipulation of the word has been their speciality as masters of deceit. In St. John 1:1, it's 1:1, probably chapter 1, verse 1, the Jewish Bible says, now listen to this carefully, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, end quotes. A strange claim indeed, but one loaded with meaning. A meaning that escaped most Gentiles, especially the preachers. What this strange bit of hocus pocus really means, in Jew language, is that with words they can create gods. And conversely, words can become as powerful as a god in controlling and directing the minds and destinies of people. The Jews have used words and propaganda profusely and relentlessly to their advantage and to the white man's detriment. They have specifically written 5 books that have had a catastrophic effect on the history of mankind and the white race in particular. So the crux of this page from Ben Klassen is, 1. Jews have realized since ancient times the power of using religion, that religion is a powerful thing. They can use it to unite their own people, and they can use it as a weapon to destroy their enemies. And then he goes and talks in depth about Jews and propaganda and how they control all of today's news media in all its forms. And then he gives this quote from the Bible. Now, Christians, most Christians, will probably immediately say, Ben Klassen doesn't understand the Bible. But just remember that Ben Klassen was a Mennonite. He came from a Mennonite society, and the Mennonites were Christians in Ukraine. His entire upbringing was in a community that was religious and that stuck together, the Mennonites. I forgot to mention in the previous section, when I was reading from Ben Klassen's book, that it is on the screen and you can actually read it and check it closely yourself. I've put another part of that page on the screen in front of you that I want to focus on. I want to read this section where he's talking about the Bible, because this thing that he's reading out of the Bible, Christians will all dispute this, but go and look at that which is written there, because that could be one of the greatest secrets that lies in the Bible that people don't notice. And Christians will say, no, 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 Ben Klassen's interpreting it wrong, etc. But I've looked at this thing myself, and it's something that I was thinking of before I discovered it in Ben Klassen's book. Ben Klassen is the only writer who's seen this and mentioned it, and it's something I used to look at and think about many times, because I used to think about certain things that are sitting in the Bible, and then I remembered this stuff about in the beginning. So Ben writes, manipulation of the word has been their speciality as masters of deceit. In St. John 1:1, which I assume is chapter 1, verse 1, the Jewish Bible says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. A strange claim indeed, but one loaded with meaning. A meaning that escaped most Gentiles, especially the preachers. What this strange bit of hocus-pocus really means in Jew language is that with words they can create gods, and conversely, words can become as powerful as a god in controlling and directing the minds and destinies of people. And I'm certain that Christians will run around. I used to look up the Christian interpretations of this particular sentence, and Christians will run around and they'll come up with all kinds of stories about this sentence. But this sentence is the sentence that might contain the most important secret that lies in the Bible. And the Christians will go in all kinds of circles to explain away that sentence. But that sentence may be the most important sentence that is sitting in the Bible. And I agree with Ben Klassen's interpretation of it, definitely, where he says, this strange bit of hocus-pocus really means, in Jew language, that with words they can create gods, and conversely, words can become as powerful as a god in controlling and directing the minds and destinies of people. That sentence may have been put into the Bible so that those who need to know it can see it and can realize the importance of what is lying there. I did come across in some research quite a while ago, mention that in the time of the Egyptians, that even lying was considered a good thing if it was beneficial for people. And the bottom line is that when I look at the world and what we as whites try to achieve, everything we try to do is based on facts, and we are conveying information, and the information must be accurate. However, I've pointed out that with Jews, words are a critical and key issue. I did a video about the Jews' greatest talent, and their greatest talent is also some hocus pocus with words, and that is the game of sophistry. And I've said time and time again that you cannot underestimate the importance of sophistry, because sophistry is when you make an argument that sounds logical and it sounds like it's got data in it, but it doesn't. And its real purpose is its effect on people. And these Jews, if you look at their use of words, they use words for effect. They use words for effect. They use words so that the words have an effect on you. And that effect that it has on you, that's what's important to them. These people are subtle, they are cunning, and they use words for their effect. Their goal is to use words to make you do things that are going to work for them. I've mentioned before with sophistry, you know, here are the Jews and they'll come at you with an argument and it sounds kind of logical. And then you might say, yeah, okay, this could be so. Jump back to Barbara Spector. Barbara Spector says, without us Jews playing the leading role in Europe, you know, to help Europe become multicultural, otherwise Europe will not survive. Notice that bizarre twist that, oh, we are here to help you. And if we don't help the people of Sweden and the Europeans to become multicultural, then they will be destroyed. What the heck is that? Well, there you are seeing some Jewish sophistry and Jewish word hocus pocus coming into play. And I want to revisit similar types of things because I'm telling you that there's even more to what she's saying than meets the eye. That at a high level in Sweden and in Europe, there's other hocus pocus that now makes those leaders and high-ranking people believe that a whites-only society has a whole bunch of negatives. How is it that they came to that kind of thinking? Jews are masters of playing with words in every conceivable way. They not only know what words to say and how to say them or misstate them or misuse them, they also know the context in which to use those words. Those words can be used in a certain context, and that context plays a big role. So when you got the rabbi and he's like, we are the chosen people, we are closer to God than you, then it's like, you must now listen to us because we know better. They use these words. And they also have the context in which they use those words. And that thing sets the scene. So now you'll get lots and lots of Christians who will not want to say certain things or who will listen to these Jews. Oh, you know, the Jews, they've been around for a long time. We got the Bible from them, etc., etc. You know, we owe them this. All that kind of stuff. And even with whites who are not religious, you will still see the Jews are coming in with angles and they are making headway right in there. So there you can see Spector, Barbara Spector, she's in there with Paideia, even getting government money so that she can do Jewish learning in a white country like Sweden. I can't stress enough, and I'm repeating what Ben Klassen himself has been telling you, I can't stress enough the importance of understanding and noticing how Jews use words and spread words. And they not only spread those words, but they are spreading messages, concepts, ideas, and they are putting ideas into people's heads. I think in one of my videos, I may even have said something like Jews need to create a place, an environment for them to live in. Almost in the same way that a cow needs to be in a nice field with some nice green grass, and the cow needs to have a field of grass that it can eat. And Jews in many ways come and with words and ideas and all these things, they come to start creating the very place that they want to live in. and they come and they tell their stories and they see which people are listening to them and which ones are not. And then when they see, these people are listening to us, then they go and they infect their minds more and they work on them. And they can take this thing to incredible levels. And now they've got a whole chunk of the people in a certain nation who now listen to them and take them seriously. Now they've got allies, but they've created all the hocus pocus, the values, the thoughts, the morals. Jews are giving you the morals and the values that they want you to have. Jews are making you listen to them on the basis of their authority, whether it's the authority of God or whether it's the authority of the longevity of the Jewish people. But whatever it is, they're coming at you and they're saying, you must listen to us. We know better than you. And they're bold. They're bold and they're aggressive and they're coming in there and they're in your face. They are preparing the groundwork for the place that they are going to inhabit and the people that they are going to work on. And they aren't afraid to go to all kinds of people, even of different races, and to go and to start telling them, advising them. But, of course, it's a case of, is it advising, is it learning, or is it misadvising them, is it misteaching them? You know, that is the whole thing. Even here in South Africa, if you read among the blacks, I saw, for example, a white Jewish woman created a black woman's organization, and she was in charge of it. So suddenly this Jewish woman is teaching all these black women all kinds of new things. And that's how these people function. They are busy, quotes, teaching, but it's not really teaching. It's propagandizing, laying the groundwork, doing all kinds of other stuff. They are busy creating things. And they know the power of those words and things and how it will stir people up. And they also go specifically with the purpose of stirring some people up against other people. These people play a lot of games, and all of their stuff at the end of the day revolves around words, concepts, values, morals. They invent the morals that everyone else lives by. And they come up with all the hocus pocus nonsense reasons why this thing is good. And, you know, 10 or 20 years later, they may decide that, you know what, we don't need those morals, we need other morals. And they'll come up with completely opposite stuff and they'll invent the reasons for the new values. Even though the new values are, let's say, diametrically opposite to the previous ones, they'll invent that stuff, man, and it'll sound like it's reasonable. And if you're not awake, they'll catch you, man. They'll catch you. They'll get into your head. They will make you start believing their stuff. They'll catch you, and they will set you on a course. But what they are busy with is they are almost like a farmer that is going around sowing seeds. You know, the farmer is, let's say, walking in the field, sowing some seeds here, sowing some seeds there, and so on, knowing full well that maybe not all the seeds are going to come up, but most of them will. And they know the power of what comes out of their mouths. They're not that clever, actually, but as people, I don't believe that they are as clever as we are. But their secret, the crux of their whole thing, is words, words, words. And they have seen the effectiveness over time of the power of their own words. And they play that game, man. They play that game all the way. And like I say, it's not about whether the words are true. It's about the effect those words are going to have on people. So if they want to stir up people, they know how to stir people up, make them angry, make them furious, make them angry at someone else, and get them to go and smash someone else. At the same time, Jews can come to people and take them and turn them into sheep and lambs and make them just sit quietly and accept all kinds of things. These people use words for effect. They know how humans work, and they know that ultimately the most powerful thing is what a person believes to be true. And they are constantly out there playing that game with people. And they do it in everything. It's not just religion. They get into politics. They get into history. They go and they play their word games everywhere. They don't care whether what they say is true or not. What's important for them is, A, they must win the argument. They must win the argument at all costs. Like my Jewish friend. I can debate liberalism with him 200 times, and I can tear it to pieces 200 times, and he will come back on the 201st time, and he'll start all over as if I had never torn the argument apart to begin with. They will try to impress you with their power. If they don't impress you with their power, then they'll try to invoke something to make you kneel down before them or bow down before them, like my Jewish friend did when he was saying, "We, the Jewish people, have a direct telephone line to God." He thought that I was the kind of person that might just fall for that, that I'd turn around and say, "Oh, yes, yes, you're right. You know, you brought us the Bible, the Ten Commandments. You know, we were fools before you came." Of course, a lot of these things actually aren't even anything as important as people believe. But, you know, when it's marketed in the correct way and people have no other frame of reference and no other knowledge to check it against or counter it, then these people can get a hell of a lot done. And of course, another thing about religion is that since you are dealing with a lot of unknowns, that makes it an easy playground to go and play in, because you can say all kinds of things and nobody will ever have the physical evidence to catch you out. But these people, words, I cannot impress enough upon you the importance of words when dealing with Jews and understanding Jews. It is so critical, and they'll try everything. And so when I look back on the past, my Jewish friend was trying by every means to get me away from becoming more and more racist and Nazi. And he could see, without me realizing it, he could see this guy might become a Nazi. This guy might yet turn around and like Hitler. I got to get him away from this. How am I going to stop it? And he may be going at the shul, talking to other Jews. I got this right-wing friend, and this guy, I can see he's becoming more and more right-wing, and he's raising all kinds of things, and he's reading more German stuff, and he's talking more about Hitler. You know, how am I going to counter this? What can we do? And the whole time, the issue is, he's not really my friend, and he sees what I'm going to become, and he's trying years ahead of the time. He's trying to prevent me from becoming what he sees I'm going to become. He knows this guy, if left alone, this guy is definitely going down that path. So I need to try and stop him. And I'll try this argument, I'll try that argument, I'll try this thing, I'll try that thing. And in desperation, you know, the one day he tries, "We have a telephone line to God." Okay, that didn't work. Got to try another thing. And so on and so forth. He is working on my mind, trying to control my mind so that I don't go where logic would otherwise take me. But these people don't just do it to like one person. They can do it to millions and millions of people. They can do it to hundreds of millions of people. They can, in fact, fool the entire world when they need to. And they're very good at it. And they spread it around the world. And they got their whole thing. And they know the power of words and the power of concepts. And it's not just the words alone. It's the words and the context in which you use those words and when you use them and how you use them. These people are so focused on pushing people in the directions where they want them to go. And they are so effective that they do it on a mass scale, on a huge scale. And they can come, oh, you see, if I don't do this and we Jews don't lead you, then all of Europe is going to be destroyed. Europe will not survive. So they come with their nonsense arguments. But those nonsense arguments clearly have value when told to the correct people because it allows her to get government funding, etc., etc. There's a whole lot more to these people than meets the eye. But at the heart of their thing is the misuse and abuse of knowledge, facts, and words. These things are so critical to them. I did a video a long time ago called The Jewish Strategy of Lying. Because at the end of the day, that's what really is going on here. They are busy with either lying outright or telling partial lies or twisting facts or whatever, but they are busy and their goal is the effect it has on people. And for them to see their power and the effect they can have on hundreds of millions of people or even billions of people, and they're confident and they go for it. And I must tell you that even if you get a quote, good Jew, who's become a Christian or whatever, I'm very skeptical about these people. I'm very skeptical. They are not the same as us. But I hope that in this video, you get a little bit of an idea also of the subtleties. Some of the subtle things, even as it relates to Christianity and you know, a good Jew in Christianity versus white Christians. You should be able to see that there are still subtle differences there. There is quite a lot more going on than meets the eye. And you see, to invoke God is a powerful tool for the Jews, and it's a tool that nobody else has, or nobody else has refined that tool like they have. So when they get to religious types of people or spiritual types of people, they're in there, man, and they can start messing with people's heads. And then they can say, oh, you see, what I'm busy doing is I'm busy teaching you, and I'm teaching you morality, and you see, you need to know this kind of morality because you see, you must do this, but you mustn't do that. You must tolerate these people and not tolerate those people. And by doing all these things, they are creating concepts in our minds. And if we accept those concepts in our minds, then unconsciously, we will start living according to the values that we now believe. And once we live according to those values that have been inculcated in our minds that we've come to accept, then it controls our behavior for the rest of our lives. And if we have children, we may even pass it on to the children. So there's a heck of a lot of power to be gained by putting thoughts in people's heads. And the Jews know it, and they go for it with gusto. And they've used it in so many situations. They've used it to either raise up kings, destroy kings, get the people to rise up to destroy the kings, get the kings to smash other people. They have played things from every conceivable angle. So they do have a lot of experience at playing all these weird games that they play. And until you grasp that they will use words for their benefit, flat out, those words will either make them rich, those words will either save them and make people tolerate them who otherwise would not tolerate them. Those words have got endless amounts of uses for them. And if you watch, for example, when Jews defend Israel, you'll see all kinds of strange things that at first don't seem to make sense. Like you'll see some Jews will openly defend Israel. Then you'll get other Jews that will go and they'll protest against Israel. Oh, we're against Israel. We're against Israel. And then people will say, oh goodness, there's some good Jews there. But meanwhile, those Jews are just playing you, man. They're just playing you to calm you down. And those Jews are mostly doing that for the people in the area where they are living. So then everyone turns around and says, oh, you see, these are good Jews. They're against Israel. Would those Jews ever pick up an AK-47 and go to Gaza and fight on the side of the Palestinians? And the answer is a big fat no, okay? But that doesn't matter to the Jews. The Jews know that what's important is the concept they get into your head. And if you say, oh, you see, Fred over there, he's a good Jew, then, you know, oh, then the Jew is one, okay? Then he's calmed you down and you believe he's a good guy and he will fake it all the way. He'll play games all the way. And of the most important outcomes of words are when you are taught values, when you are taught spiritual values and values that direct your life. That is extremely powerful. And for them, they go around, look at the Jews, at modern Jews, for example. You know, the Jews have turned Hitler. Oh, Hitler, he was evil. Hitler murdered the Jews. He gassed the Jews. Nazis, they're all evil and bad. But they do that so that everybody else hammers down the Nazis and keep the Germans down and keep the friends of the Germans down. That's the real purpose of this stuff. It's a kind of a terrorism. It's a kind of method of using other people to do your dirty work for you. The Jews can't be everywhere to watch every single modern Nazi, but they know that if they keep inculcating certain thoughts in people's heads and those thoughts get into those people's heads successfully, then other people will do their deeds for them. They won't even have to go and tell those people. Some other guy who totally believes in the Jewish Holocaust story might see a guy who's a Nazi and, you know, he'll immediately start working for that guy's downfall. Ah, he's a Nazi, and telling other people about it. Watch out for him. And, you know, this and this and this. And, you know, we should maybe not get this guy promoted and that kind of thing. And start a whispering campaign around that person, etc. There are 1,001 uses for this. If you get this accepted at a high level and if you can get it across to huge numbers of people, to tens of millions, hundreds of millions, or billions of people, if you can get a successful message through to those people, then you've done it, man. You just have to sit back and remind them every now and then about the values, and they will, in the meantime, be doing their own thing. In the meantime, they'll be busy trying to destroy Nazis. When they come across a Nazi, they'll start working to bugger up his life, etc. And the same is true with anti-Semitism. So you go and you spread the word of anti-Semitism. Oh, I see. Oh, people, they were gassed. They were gassed and gassed by these nasty Nazis. And if you believe their fake stories, then all that's going to happen is people who believe those stories are then going to work against anyone who's a, quote, anti-Semite. And he might even go to a Jew and say, oh, you know, Fred, You see that other guy over there, he's actually an anti-Semite, you know? And all these things, when it's spread enough, then it comes back and it helps them. It comes back and it helps them in an informal way, and it can have massive effects without them even lifting a finger. They don't even have to tell people, oh, you must go and do something against an anti-Semite. Other people will do it by themselves, of their own accord, because they believe it to be true. The final point is that you have to believe that what they've told you is true. That is the only time that it really has an effect, is if you believe it to be true. Then you will walk the narrow line and you will stick with it. But if the Jews tell their story and a guy doesn't believe it to be true or even laughs at it, you know, then the whole thing is flopped. So for them, they will have their methods of either testing the waters or trying this lie, and then they might see that they get some pushback or people don't believe it, so then they modify the lie, and they keep modifying the lie until they see, yeah, this lie looks like it's working, you know, let's go full ball. And off they go, man. And their goal is to control your mind as much as possible. They can't control it exactly, but even if they can get you to buy into some of their values, they're already scoring big time. And things like spirituality, morality, these are powerful, powerful tools. These are powerful tools. I hope that if nothing else, that this video has made you think, that it makes you sit and think a bit and think about things that are subtle and look around you. I will return to this topic of the controlling of masses of people. This is extremely important. And when I see the importance of having the right values in life, then I think to myself, you know, this is one of the most critical things of all. And returning to Ben Klassen, that is what Ben Klassen was trying to deal with. He was trying to come up with a religion for whites, a religion that would work for whites. And creativity is what he came up with, which I love. And if in your travels and your exploring, you come across more stuff about Jews, talking about how chosen they are, Jews and God and all that kind of stuff, or Jews and propaganda, feel free to pass it on to me. I have got a lot of stuff, but I can always add more. And I find that these rabbis can be very critical people. I have said for a long time that the root of all evil are these rabbis. These rabbis, they are the root of all evil. They are not to be laughed at, and they are not like Christian pastors. They are completely different. So I hope you got some food for thought and things to mull over. We'll be chatting again.
If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you will win every fight.